This is the Saxo Market Call, the daily financial markets podcast, across asset classes and around the world.
Hello and welcome to the Saxo Market Call. It is Friday, 21st of April, 2023. Market sentiment dipping a little bit yesterday. I suppose in part on that soft U.S. data, the Philly Fed coming in, we were talking about, could it be that we see a whiplash positive number there as we did with the Empire Manufacturing? That was certainly not the case, as it was even worse than expected at -31.3, an acceleration to the downside. Although the overall headline figure was a little bit more dire than some of the internals, new orders, et cetera, but not a good report by any means, and sort of scotching that whole idea that we're seeing a manufacturing renaissance, at least judging from those two regional surveys. We did see an uptick in the claims as well, still not above 250K, and you have to get well above 250K to start talking about a much looser U.S. jobs market, and you would have to sustain those levels for several weeks. As well at the margin, surely this Tesla falling 10%-ish on the day, not good news for the broader market, certainly one of the most speculated upon stock, does that poorly. And the guidance that they are essentially engaging in a price war and not going to be trying to maintain very thick margins to ensure that the competition is not gaining market share is a concern across the industry. Something like Ford, who has its E-Lightning pickup truck and the E-Mustang down something like 8% over the last couple of sessions. Not a good day for Elon Musk with his Starship, supposedly, at least on the headlines, with his Starship having to be blown up. I took a picture of the rockets there, six of which of the 33 at one point not firing, as you can see in that picture. Still, by many, considered a pretty successful launch. The thing did get off the ground. It did go quite high before they had to blow it up because of its instability. But sentiment is soft, and we do have this debt ceiling issue, and we're seeing increasing signs of scrambling there. I'll get to that in a moment. We have our Chief Investment Officer, Stein Jakobsen, on the call, and I'll talk about that and about this really interesting ECB speech from President Lagarde on central banks in a fragmenting world was the title of the speech. But first, Ole, you're also on the call on commodities, and you have to run here. So let's have a look at a couple things we've been seeing here. Essentially weak price action across much of the commodity space, both in energy and then a pretty big sell-off in iron ore overnight as well.
Yeah, the market is somewhat spooked by the by what seems to be a bit of a slow pickup in demand from China. Steel mills are not revving up as expected, and I think it's also a question of some of these major iron ore producers have been ramping up production in anticipation of strong demand from China, which is currently not living up to expectations. So we're seeing prices coming down. We at this level on the Singapore based iron ore contract, it's fairly weak close that we're heading towards, and potentially not boding well for the coming week. And as a result of that, we're seeing the world's top one iron ore miner, Rio Tinto, and Fortescue, which is top four, suffering some setbacks here in the Asian or the Australian trading session today. So something that we need to keep an eye on. But you mentioned general weakness, and we also seen that spread to other markets. And then I think interesting, before we just talk about crude oil here on slide five, was the weakness we've seen in gold. Yesterday, as you mentioned, John, we had this pretty dismal Philly Fed data, and we had a small pop in gold, and as short-term interest rates pointed towards a fresh increase in rate cut expectations, but gold failed to attract a bit on the back of that, and that does indicate that we are in for a prolonged period of consolidation here, and the risk down to 1955, that first key area of support, is still something we need to be aware of. Generally negative week, and then just finishing off on the commodity space, the crude oil, we've been talking about this gap for a while now, and we're getting close to having it to removing that from the focus. We are getting close to $80 in Brent. The problem, obviously, with that is what happens next, because with OPEC having squeezed all the shorts out on April 3rd, only to invite fresh longs in at a high price around $84.50, $85. we're now basically at risk that what happens if we break back below 80, we could actually see fresh short selling come into the market. So OPEC is at least for now is to blame for some of the volatility we're seeing in the market, and if we do break below 80, that potentially could extend the, well, could see prices weaken beyond what's fundamentally justified right now. But the driver, as we mentioned earlier in the week, has been these falling refinery margins, the so-called cracks, both in London and New York and also in Asia. And as long as we continue to see downward pressure on those cracks, then the market is obviously worried about the overall demand outlook.
All right, thanks for that. And sort of picking up on that commodity topic, Steen, when you look at this commodity picture, there's been a lot of trouble in at least expressing the China reopening trade via commodities. What do you make of that? Is it just because the opening is not happening to the degree expected, or is it something more to do with perhaps where the focus is and the stimulus, not on the sort of the mobilizing infrastructure and the property market, et cetera, to the scale they did in previous rounds of stimulus? What do you make of the commodity space in general?
It's pretty clear and also for me disappointing that the spillover from a very strong set of economic data out of China is not really doing anything for commodities. And the reason for that, in simple terms, with 2020 clarity is, of course, that most of the improvement is in the service sector so far. Only over the last 2 weeks have international travel, which of course, due to the fuel consumption, is a big thing in the land of commodity picking up. So it's picking up at double digit percentage points, but of course it was down 90%. So it takes quite a while to rebound some of that. I am pretty certain that our call on China, which has been that the low in economic activity was in Q4 22, and then using our credit impulse 9 months forward. So basically, you know, whatever happens 9 months ago is on the credit side is now being impacted, will lead to even higher data. Similar to Ole, I think the oil prices have a flaw, and I think overall China, when commodity price becomes too cheap, will be buying. But net, John, as you say, very disappointing performance, but so far mainly due to the fact that the spillover. The second part is, and that is just to add, not that I want to make this complicated, but I think the recent increase in tension between the US and China is also one of the reasons why we are trading sideways to lower in equity and equity risk. I think we, so far as the market has been ignoring this news, but now it's getting very difficult as Biden on G7 in the end of May will be putting forward new suggestion how to curtail investment into China. China is reciprocating with very, very strong language on how they see this is trying to get China out. And that, of course, is a beautiful segue into what Lagarde talks about.
Yeah. And actually, before we get to that, it is a key point. And the one you mentioned, the G7 meeting, this news that he's readying something, it looked like it was new as of yesterday. So we're all bracing for that. But just briefly, before we get to the Lagarde speech, which is the main reason I wanted to have you on the podcast today, do you have any angle on this ongoing debt ceiling debate? I mean, it's pretty remarkable, some of the market expression of what's going on here. Put a couple of things on slide three, just showing that the U.S. T-bill is traded as for a four-week T-bill trades at 305 bid, 337 offered, so a three-spot 25%-ish. Mid-range there when the Fed policy rate is 4.87%. So 150 basis point discount, obviously, because this bill expires before the window of the perceived risk zone of this debt ceiling issue coming to a crisis as early as June because of weak tax revenues when it was thought that this issue could limp on potentially into July, August. The Republican House has passed something that's a complete non-starter with the Democrats who want a clean lifting of the ceiling. Do you have any take on this? I mean, I really don't understand how far they're willing to take this, but it just seems like there is a fairly high risk of these shenanigans continuing up to the sort of the last second type of setup.
The last thing you say is given because we are in a election campaign, and that campaign is going to be driven by One camp wanting to be seen to be fiscally conservative, the other one wants to solve for basically weather and everything else happening to the world. But I think in terms of the market, the first thing we need to address is the fact that as the US government is not in a position to issue new bonds and new T-bills, of course, what happens is that they run down their account with the treasury account, which is whatever they get in terms of tax revenues and everything else. That has been a very large input to the market in terms of liquidity. So in other words, the fact that we are up against this deadline is actually ironically providing extra tailwind for the market in terms of liquidity. The second part is that, as you rightly say, most people now assume that we will be early June when we need the absolute deadline for this. And this is due to the fact that tax revenue, tax receipts is coming in below what is expected, both adjusted for seasonality, but also in terms of what goes on. And that's probably the final point, that we just passed the tax return in the US. And for a number of reasons, this has massive impact on money market funds, people selling and buying equity before and after. So it's a very dangerous season, because we have a lot of, not asynchronic, but synchronic risks that are all based on the fact that the government needs to raise its revenue. So very, very clear to me that this is becoming an even bigger issue. So I think we've been on a simple macro discussion between recession and inflation. Unfortunately, we now need to add two additional components, one being this potential lockdown, and the second one being the escalation into the G7 meeting on the China rhetoric.
Yeah, very good points there. And a lot of the Treasury General Account, we put a chart in yesterday's slide deck, if anybody wants to link to that, showing how that Treasury account has been wound down since late January on a scale of $500 billion and sort of getting to the lowest level it can get to now. So that sort of source, as you say, of liquidity is pretty much running dry at this point. All right, let's get along to the ECB and President Lagarde's speech. She gave that speech, and now I'm forgetting the think tank. It's a very old think tank in Washington, almost 100 years old, I believe it is. Central banks in a fragmenting world. And you know, both you and I have joked a little bit back and forth, and I've mentioned as well on the podcast, Lagarde is not somebody that's been a very engaging central banker in terms of the press conferences, and very difficult, and does not seem to have a grasp of the role that she occupies. But this was a pretty wide-ranging and hefty speech with some very key and incisive points, and some of these were echoed in our Q2 outlook on where the world is going from here. And clearly it's not coming from her desk alone. It's probably after consultation and communication with a lot of the other politicians in Europe. So what do you make of this speech? How would you position it? And you know, not just as content, but how would you position it, the importance of a speech like this?
The fact it's Lagarde, and it's a very, 100,000 feet, not even 10,000 feet, but 100,000 feet speech means that something is going on behind the scene here. And if, I think it's critical that in the space of less than 2 weeks, we had the Macron in China talking about how China, Europe needs to have an autonomous policy. We have seen the EU Council President talking about an autonomous foreign policy in Europe, its independence. Now have the ECB central bank government talking about it. And on top of that, we have Yellen now saying that national security is more important than economic coexistence with China. And you have that Biden is going to put forward a proposal that's been in the works for 2 years at the G7, where he's obviously trying to achieve some sort of a common standard on how we are going to deal with China. All of it is a massive escalation. It is very clear to me that this is coordinated. So, to a large extent, we were lucky to bring the fragmentation headline into our last outlook, because this is a major scale. You are either with us or without us speech. And I think that was some of the commentary that we saw from some of the smartest people out there, like Isabella Kaminska after the initial dropping of this speech in Washington. Do you want me to sort of outline the three major points that she had?
Sure, let's do that. And also, I thought it was interesting, this talk of interdependence rather than independence, and not just I think within not I think, but not with just within a Eurozone context, But seemingly, you know, the idea that we need to almost get together and coordinate our policies across where we are aligned in terms of national security.
Absolutely. So you know, she has three major points. She is talking about the fact that we will have a very likely multipolar international currency system. For those of you out there who thinks that the dollar is on the slow and will start to diminish in power, this is what she talks about. She's saying they are in the classic US-based fiat system. Dollar has been used as a bartering currency. It's been used for roughly 90% of all cross-border coalitions. Due to the fact, she didn't mention that directly, but of course, because of the sanction of Russia's money during the early parts of the Ukraine war, a number of countries outside the Western alliances is now looking for a new geopolitical reality, which is that they're going to, you know, shift their currency towards potentially renminbi, could be gold, could be a basket of currencies like we've seen the development bank for these countries talk about. That's the first one. Then she talks about the more practical part that in order to achieve the right policy framework, you really need to go to what you talk about, the interdependence. Not only do you need to make sure that you secure your resources at home and your fiscal policy is one that is given almost its entire focus to making sure we have resources, we have computer powers, and we have security, but you need to do it in a global context of greater system competition. She uses this wording exactly, greater system competition. She's really saying out loud, and this is very remarkable for a central banker, it would have been remarkable for any person in any cabinet in a Western government, but this is a central banker who talks about a competing system between basically us, the Western world, and the rest of the world. And then she talks about, and this is also critical and probably for those out there who are in the crypto space, slightly interesting, the need for central banks to innovate their payment system and potentially issue digital currency to navigate the digital era. So what she's saying is that as the world goes off the dollar, people will be seeking, the market will be seeking alternatives, and the central banks needs to make sure that they have the digital framework to operate these alternative currencies. She simply is constantly saying we live in a fragmented world, we need to be dependent on who's with us and who's against us. So to a large extent, this goes back to George W. the second after 9/11. So I'm not going to compare these two things because of course of the massive personal losses we have in 9/11 and the increase in security threats that happened after that. But in terms of the magnitude and the sort of the waves that's going to come from this speech, I think it's pretty clear that she are declaring loud and clear, you are with us or without us. We are the central banks. We see a central role in this. And fiscal policy needs to be conducted in such a way that it is not income substitution, but it's really about building a better infrastructure. It's about getting computer power. It's about getting a security balance right. And it is about recognizing that indirectly she's saying to European politicians, you need to step up here and smell the coffee.
Yeah, I think that last point is absolutely massive. And it's a bit ironic this is coming from a central banker because under the new regime, as you talk about, it's what many are calling fiscal dominance. So it really, the central bank will simply be a sort of an auxiliary or an accessor, you know, an accessory to whatever the fiscal side needs to do. And the Eurozone has a huge test that it needs to pass to get there. It shows that in times of emergency, like with the Russia's invasion of Ukraine, things can happen and happen very swiftly. But I guess you would agree it's not fully settled yet with the single central bank and the multiple sovereigns just yet, is it?
No, and that's another call that comes out of it. Basically, if you start to take the first derivative or the first sort of next iteration of that, that is that we need a fiscal union in Europe. We need to get a political government for Europe that works, not one that is, you know, indirectly voted into power through the European Parliament, the European Council ministers. This is a huge criticism of the way that we navigate. And she is, you know, between the lines, criticizing the inability of Europe to actually step up and be speedy in all things that has to do with foreign policy and fiscal policy, which, of course, she's very much a part of herself by making convoluted suggestions about ESG and green bonds and accepting that, you know, we are, on a weekly basis are diluting the master criteria that we are allowing the EU Commission now to not only issue tax calls, but also to issue bonds, which at least when I did studies with the mighty professor Niels Thuesen, who did the law committee report, was entirely opposite of what was intended with the Maastricht and the overall euro introduction.
Yeah. All right, Stijn, thanks so much for your analysis there and thoughts. I have to put the G7 meeting in May on our longer term highlights on the macro calendar for sure. And I'm sure we'll update our thoughts ahead of that. All right, just to round out the podcast, let's have a look at the earnings watch today. Actually, not even though it's a Friday, it's a pretty decent number of companies reporting with some heft. So we have the German software maker SAP, Procter & Gamble, a consumer giant, always interesting to hear what they're having to say about consumption patterns. And Schlumberger, the largest oil services company, together with huge miner, international miner, really, is US-based equity, but very internationally based. Around 30% of their revenue is coming from copper, and that's Freeport McMoRan. So those are all reporting today. You can argue that the next 2 weeks after this week are really the heart of the earnings season. Next week, I listed up a few companies in today's quick take. And those include Visa, Alphabet, Microsoft, Boeing, Intel, Caterpillar, MasterCard, McDonald's, oil giants ExxonMobil and Chevron, and then Berkshire Hathaway, which I believe reports on a Saturday. All those are up just next week. And then the following week, we'll have the rest of the mega caps. Regarding today's macro calendar, you can slide forward to slide 6, and you can see we're looking at these preliminary manufacturing and services PMIs. Today, those don't get a lot of focus in the U.S. The Eurozone ones often do, and I don't have those in front of me, but those have been out this morning, of course. Next week, the big focus will be the Bank of Japan. Actually, I didn't cover FX very much, but just a brief note there. If you roll back to roll forward, I'll put the slide in on slide 8. The FX situation, you can see that the yen has really pulled back here. Part of that, I think, on this risk sentiment dip. But I think the strength of the move is quite interesting, possibly on the CPI figures out of Japan, surprising a bit to the upside. And even though we saw a statement issued as recently as yesterday that they're concerned about tweaking YCC so soon after the banking turmoil, they're going to be dragged kicking and screaming, it seems, into normalization. But it's just interesting to see the market playing the yen to this degree on fairly thin news flow and fairly thin developments and coincident indicators like treasury yields, et cetera, dipping. All right. It's really macro-wise, though, that, of course, G7, but the week after next, where it really gets big with the two key central bank meetings, the FOMC and ECB, and then the next non-farm payrolls change and employment report out of the U.S. that week as well. That is a wrap for today. We thank you so much for joining, and we'll be back, of course, Monday with the next Saxo Market Call. Until then, have a great weekend. See you next week.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Saxo Market Call. For feedback and questions, reach out to us on Twitter @SaxoMarketCall or by email, marketcall@saxobank.com.